Chapter 41, Explorations in the North, The New Found Land. After Columbus and Amerigo Vespucci sailed across the Atlantic, other Europeans followed. The Spanish and Portuguese planted their colonies in Central and South America. The English did their best to settle in Virginia, and further up north in North America, another colony began to form on the island of Newfoundland. This colony wasn't Spanish, Portuguese, or English. It was filled with settlers from all different nations. It had many different names and many different languages, but like the English Newfoundland, these names all mean new land. Today, Newfoundland is part of the country of Canada. The colony on Newfoundland, which was often known by its French name, Terre-Neuve, got its start when a merchant named John Cabot sailed north from England and bumped into the North American coast. John Cabot was a little bit like the people who would follow him to Newfoundland. He was from several different countries. He was born in Italy, tried living in Spain, and then came to England. Here, he convinced the English to help him pay for a journey of exploration. Like Columbus, John Cabot wanted to find a quick way to get to India. He thought that if he sailed north, he might find the fastest possible route to the east. 5 years after Columbus landed in America, John Cabot began his own journey into the North Atlantic. He had only 20 men and a single small ship, the Matthew. But his journey was even shorter than he had expected. Before too many weeks had passed, Cabot sighted land ahead of him. An island, rocky and fog-shrouded, rose out of the ocean. Cabot sailed around the island's shores and found that beyond it lay a huge forested mass of land. He could glimpse grassy meadows beyond the beaches. Silver streams trickled through the meadows down to the sea. As Cabot's ship cruised along this new coast, his men leaned over the ship's rail, their mouths open with astonishment. The water was filled with large fish leaping around the ship's bow. "Quick," one said, "lower a basket down." They tied a rope to a nearby wicker basket and dragged it through the water beside the ship. When they pulled it up, it was full of codfish, perfect for eating. This was the easiest fishing they had ever done. John Cabot beached his ship, climbed ashore, and announced, "I claim this land for England." Then he sailed back to England and reported, "I have found the shortest route to the northeast coast of Asia. There are so many fish in the water that England's fishermen could feed the whole country. Now I want to return with more ships and look for the spices of the East." Of course, John Cabot hadn't reached Asia. He had landed on the northern part of North America. But he was sure that he had accomplished his goal. The following spring, he left England with 5 ships, ready to finish his journey to the East. Months later, one of the ships limped back to England, tattered by storms. It had never reached North America. Winds had driven it off course, and its captain had decided to give up the journey. John Cabot and the other 4 ships had disappeared entirely. No one ever saw or heard from them again. Probably the ship sank in the North Atlantic. But even though Cabot never made it back to his new land, English fishermen had heard stories about the swarms of fish in Cabot's newfound land. They set out with their own boats to follow John Cabot's route. When these fishermen came back with the holds of their ships stuffed full of fish, word spread quickly. Other fishermen from France, Spain, Portugal, and other European countries followed them. They fished around the island of Newfoundland and even ventured into the rivers that ran through the vast expanse of land that lay just beyond the island. Many fishermen built huts on the island of Newfoundland and stayed all summer long. They built wooden platforms called flakes, where they salted and dried the fish so that their catch wouldn't spoil. Little fishing villages sprang up around Newfoundland's best harbor. Merchants came to Newfoundland to sell food, ropes, iron hooks and harpoons, clothes, shoes, and medicines to the fishermen. This fishing settlement became known as St. John's. It was the first European colony in the country that we now call Canada. But the colony of St. John's wasn't exactly like the other colonies in North and South America. The fishermen who lived in St. John's only stayed in their colony during the spring and summer. When the breezes that blew across the island began to grow colder, St. John's settlers started packing their fish, their tools and clothes, and all of their fishing tackle into their ships for the journey home. No one tried to stay all winter on the island of Newfoundland. Icy winds would blow across St. John's, sucking the warmth from the little wooden huts. Fog would descend on the settlement so thick that one colonist couldn't see another across the street. Snow would cover the houses, the flakes, and the merchants' shops. The nights would grow longer and longer. Huge, unpredictable storms would sweep down from the north and cover the island, lashing at the harbors and shores. Cakes of ice would form in the waters surrounding Newfoundland. Ships still anchored off Newfoundland's shore would be frozen into the water. St. John's was a fantastic place to fish, but not to live. For many years, no one would stay on this northern island all year long. The first settlement in Canada would remain a warm-weather colony. Jacques Cartier's discoveries. Spain, Portugal, and England were all building colonies in the Americas. The King of France decided that he didn't want to be left out. When he learned about the fish-filled waters around Newfoundland, he ordered a French explorer named Jacques Cartier to go find out more about this new land. So Jacques Cartier set off to claim some of the new land for France. But Cartier had another plan in mind as well. He still wanted to find a way to China. He hoped that he could sail through the North Atlantic Ocean, find a river that cut through the whole continent of North America, come out the other side, and then sail straight to the Chinese coast. Cartier got a good start to his adventure. His journey to North America took less than 3 weeks. When he arrived at Newfoundland, he sailed around the island and drew a map of it. Then he explored and mapped the smaller islands nearby. Now it was time to look for the river that would take him all the way across the continent. Cartier sailed past Newfoundland into the waters that we now call the Gulf of St. Lawrence. He discovered that these waters ended in a river that seemed to wind straight into North America. Could this be the river that flowed through the continent? Perhaps it was. But before Cartier could explore this river, he had to make friends with the Native Americans who lived nearby. He didn't want to sail down his newly discovered river with hostile tribes on either bank, ready to attack him as soon as he landed. So Cartier and his men landed on the North American shores and made friends with the people who lived there, the Mi'kmaqs. The Mi'kmaqs had learned how to survive the cold northern winters. They lived in wigwams, cone-shaped huts made of animal skins stretched over wooden timbers. These wigwams could be taken apart and moved. So during the warm summers, the Mi'kmaqs moved their villages to the coast, where they would fish and swim in the waters. In the fall, when the wind began to grow cold, the Mi'kmaqs took their wigwams apart and journeyed back into the deep woods away from the ocean. Here the trees would protect them from the cold northern winds. When Cartier asked the Mi'kmaqs, "What is this land called?" they thought he was asking them the name of their small summer settlement on the coast. "We call it the village," they answered him. In the Mi'kmaq language, the village sounds like Canada. So Cartier called all of the vast expanse of land before him Canada. We still call it Canada today. As Cartier explored the Mi'kmaq land, he met a hunting party from another tribe who lived further away, along the river that Cartier hoped would lead him to China. This tribe was called the Hurons. Their chief, Donnacona, and his two sons were part of the hunting party. When they described their home to Cartier, he wanted to sail down the river at once to see it. But winter was coming, and Cartier knew that his men might not be able to survive the Canadian cold. He decided, reluctantly, that they would return to France and come back again in the spring. But he wanted to show his new discoveries to the French king. So he asked Donnacona, "Can I take your sons back to France with me?" Donnacona didn't want his two boys to disappear into the mysterious waters beyond Newfoundland, but finally he agreed to let his sons go. They waved goodbye to their father and boarded Cartier's ship, which sailed away and vanished over the horizon. Donnacona waited and waited. An entire year went by with no sign of his boys. Would his sons ever return? Finally, Donnacona heard reports that the strangers had landed again on the coast of Canada. He gathered a party of warriors with him and hurried towards the ships. When the Hurons arrived, they saw Cartier and his men preparing to journey into Canada along the river. And they also saw Donnacona's sons. They were taller and stronger. "The Frenchmen want to sail down the river towards our homeland," they told their father. Donnacona was grateful to have his boys back. He welcomed Cartier and treated him as a friend. So Cartier and his men began their journey down the river, which we now call the St. Lawrence River. They sailed farther and farther down the St. Lawrence River, closer and closer to Huron land. And soon Donnacona began to get nervous. How far would these strangers go? What would they do to the Huron people when they landed? When Cartier came ashore at the Huron village where Donnacona lived and announced, "I claim this land for France," Donnacona decided they had gone far enough. "No further," he ordered. "I am the king of this land, and I command you to stop here." And three of Donnacona's priests, or medicine men, dressed up like devils to frighten Cartier. "Go no further," they warned, "or disaster will come upon you." Cartier ignored Donnacona and his priests. He boarded his ships again and went on. But soon the river began to grow shallower and narrower. Cartier watched the shores nervously. If the St. Lawrence went all the way to the Pacific, it would grow wider and deeper again. Before long, Cartier saw rapids ahead, places in the river where the bottom is so shallow that huge rocks jut up into the air through the water. The water bubbled and frothed around these rocks. Cartier knew that the river was coming to an end. The St. Lawrence would not lead him to China. But he didn't want to return to France empty-handed, and he had heard the Hurons tell tales about a rich land filled with gold and jewels farther north. So Cartier went back to Donnacona's village and kidnapped the king of the Hurons. He took him back to France to tell these tales of treasure to the French king. Donnacona died in France without ever seeing his native country again. When the French king heard the stories of a rich, mysterious northern land, he sent Cartier back for a third trip. This time Cartier found another river, lined with sparkling stones all along its banks. He was sure that he had discovered the land of jewels. But when he arrived back in France with his boatload of treasure, the French laughed at him. The stones were worthless common quartz, and the stories of the Hurons had just been fairy tales. Cartier, disgusted, never returned to Canada. But his journeys to Canada had shown other explorers and traders that there was much more land to discover beyond the Gulf of St. Lawrence. Soon, French merchants were making regular journeys to Canada, trading with the Indians for rich skins and other goods. 70 years later, the French established the first year-round colony in Canada. Today, many people who live in Canada speak French because of the French-speaking settlers who came to live in this new land.